Hello and welcome to Banfield. No 13-year-old should ever have to watch his dad die. With paramedics standing just a few feet away, waiting for red tape to clear. But a young boy's tragedy in Seattle should make us all sit up and take notice of some good intentions that had lethal consequences. That story for you in just a few moments, but first, some cases just look like a slam dunk. A sure thing. Open and shut. After all, the news headlines tell you so. Overwhelming evidence. Consciousness of guilt. Think about it. How many times were you certain a trial was going to go one way, only to be shocked when it didn't? O.J. Simpson. Michael Jackson. Casey Anthony. George Zimmerman. The truth is, things are very, very different in the courtroom than they are on the TV. And a soundbite, no matter how powerful, is very different when you're right there in the room. So if you think you know what's going to happen in the Kyle Rittenhouse case, think again. The jury doesn't even know what's going to happen. They just got the case. And up until now, even they have been forbidden from talking amongst themselves. The first indication of how a jury leans sometimes starts to emerge with their first questions. And then it's just a parlor game as to how their actual verdict is going to shake out. And whatever anyone is saying on TV, in the paper, on the podcasts, I can assure you, it is not the same thing that the jury is discussing in private. Joining me now is one man who has lived that process. His client was assumed guilty by court watchers and TV watchers alike until the jury said he wasn't. Mark O'Mara defended George Zimmerman in the killing of Trayvon Martin, so he knows a thing or two. Mark, I thought of you as the jury got this case, and as all the pundits weighed in, and as the coverage blanketed cable news all day today, and I thought, oh, you lived that. How do we get it so wrong so often?
Well, because everyone has their predispositions. It's called confirmation bias or implicit biases or whatever. And the first thing that hits us is what we want to believe. And then since we believe it to begin with, everything else we run through that filter. And we know those are very difficult for jurors to get away with and to get away from. So in this case, yes, everyone wants to look at the 17-year-old kid with a long gun and say, guilty as could be because of everyone he shot. And quite honestly, morally, that may well be true. But in a courtroom, as you and I know so well, it doesn't have to make human logic or human common sense, but it does have to make legal logic. And the laws in this case are going to make this jury's job, I think, very difficult for an acquittal, for a conviction. And we may try this again if they cannot convince each one of 12 that there's a reason for a unanimous verdict.
Only takes one to hang up a jury and to throw the whole process out. We've been through it a lot. So one thing I wanted to talk to you about, because all weekend long I was talking to people about Kyle Rittenhouse crying on the stand, and everybody has a different comment. What a faker, or, oh my Lord, I didn't know he was like that. And, you know, if you saw the soundbite on all the cable news channels, you could make a split decision about what he was like. But if you watched the testimony all day long with him and then saw that happen, you might feel very differently. Is that kind of what I'm saying in a nutshell when it comes to a court case?
Absolutely right. Yeah, we take our sound bites and then we extrapolate onto those, for we know the entirety of the case and we know what should happen. But the harsh reality is, and let's use that sound bite as an example. Here's a now 18-year-old kid crying. It looks like he was just so upset. And now we should believe him, right, because he's crying. But the prosecutor said something I thought was very, very insightful when he said, you know, Rittenhouse was crying when they were coming at him. He was not crying for the people he shot and killed. And that got across to the jury. They're going to sit back and go, yeah, crying for yourself isn't what we need to hear in this courtroom.
You're like one of the guys I would ask to tell me what you think about how this case went, because I know you see everything through a different lens. You lived in a world, and if my viewers don't know this right now, I'm going to let them know some of the awful, horrible realities that you and your wife lived through with the Zimmerman trial. Death threats, rape threats, FBI, I think we're living with you for a couple of months at one point. Were there over, was it 2,000 different violent threats?
2,500 of them that were looked at by Homeland Security, yeah.
Yeah, so that's the lawyer, not even the defendant. So Mark O'Meara and his wife, who had nothing to do with that court case, she was getting that as well. And I guess that's why you have this real sensibility of what it really is like in the courtroom as opposed to the TV show. So what is your impression, understanding you weren't physically trying this case, you weren't in that courtroom, but you breathe and eat this DNA all differently than we do?
So I really do think that this jury is going to have a difficult time, because in one sense, you look at the state's case and they plotted through it, but they showed good evidence. And they said, look, this kid came to the area with a gun, didn't have to shoot. Nobody else shot anybody. All of a sudden, this kid does guilty. The defense comes up and says, well, hold on a second. Didn't do all that much wrong. And he only shot when somebody attacked him. And what I thought was really good by what the defense said, which the jury is also going to think about, is, you know what? Kyle Rittenhouse didn't shoot at anybody he didn't need to. And even as one of the people who came at him, but then stopped and backed up, he didn't shoot that person. So Kyle Rittenhouse's non-shooting actions could lead to his acquittal.
So here's another question that it's not about the facts or the evidence in the case, but it's a big part of the case, which I think is weird. I heard a commentator on cable last week say this case is all about race. And I kind of had to look sideways for a minute, like the defendant is a white guy. The guy who was injured is a white guy. And the two dead men are white men. I get it. These were racial protests, but this case is about white people. And how is it that even in your case, it became about, about people of color, but apparently Zimmerman wasn't considered to be a person of color and he's Hispanic. So I couldn't quite understand that what people ascribe to these cases.
Sure. And in Zimmerman, the misunderstandings, let's call them, were easy. You know, George, big, heavyset, white guy, even though he wasn't truly white, against the small, young black kid in Trayvon. So that was easy. In this case, because everybody may have been there and because the protest that turned, you know, arsonist, because that was so racially motivated, we've sort of taken race and dumped it onto this case. But it really, as you said, it really doesn't belong, because if anything, it's a vigilante justice case. Do we allow people to run around with long rifles and shoot people if they feel the need? And it's also about, you know, Second Amendment rights. You know, what are we going to do about people who have guns and can use them? But this race issue on top of it doesn't fit the facts, but it does get the focus.
Yeah. And the one thing I kept wondering is I heard about all sorts of, you know, concern and proactivity on the part of law enforcement. If, oh my gosh, a verdict comes out that the people don't like, and then I wonder, but who would, right?
That's my point. It's like, wait a minute. So 500 National Guardsmen are on standby. Who is going to protest? If he gets convicted, then gun rights advocates are going to protest. Well, okay, but not shown to be a very violent bunch in the past. If he gets acquitted, who's going to protest? So I don't know, again, without the racial component that sort of set itself upon this case, not factually based, I don't know why we're worried about a verdict one way or the other in this case, unless you're talking about we need to be more careful with our long guns.
You know, it's weird, though. People who watch high-profile trials, they always ask the same questions. Okay, how long is the jury going to be out? And it's a crazy question, but at the same time, having spent, you know, the better part of two decades covering trials, and you having, you know, a couple decades of actually litigating them, there is a weird kind of theorem that you can apply. And it's sort of, not for all cases, but it's sort of, 1 week of testimony is about a day of deliberations. Does that fit a lot of your past?
Yes, it actually does, because if you think about it, what we want our jurors to do, we don't really know what they do back there, but what we want them to do is go back there, pick a person, a jury for a person, that's easy. But then go through all the evidence, make sure that you all understand the evidence. Somebody may have missed what a witness said. So question each other about that. And then every person give a quick, not solidified opinion, but a quick opinion. What do you think? And then the other jurors are supposed to sort of question that juror. So if you look at it that way, then the more evidence, the more of that interchange should happen. And it should take a while. My only hope is that this jury takes a long enough time so the rest of us watching at least presume or believe that they really have, you know, talked about it, really have thought it through and really have given attention to it, because it is a significant trial. And my fear has always been that we are losing, we're denigrating our belief in the juvenile and the jury system. And if jurors come out with more and more verdicts that are not agreed to by some, all, or at least most of the population, we're going to start disbelieving that the jury system works. And that's very frightening.
Oh, wow. Listen, in OJ, it was 9 months of trial testimony and the jury was sequestered and mad as all get out. And they came to deliberations with their bags packed. And it was I think it was 3 hours and 50 minutes or something. It was the worst. I just felt sick about that process entirely. But at the same time, I'm always very concerned about jurors that aren't sequestered in a high profile trial. Real quickly from the inside, and you have to be very honest with me here. When everything wraps up and the jury is instructed and then everybody clears the courtroom and you're sitting there with the defendant, what do you tell them? Like, what do you say? How do you prepare them for, basically, this is it. Your life could be over right now.
We tried our best. We put on a good case. The jury should understand self-defense and should let you go. Jurors have a lot that they bring to it. They may not understand or believe us. You may well get convicted of a lesser included offense, and you're just going to have to deal with it. No reaction to the jury verdict. If we have an appellate right, we'll take it. But, you know, we put on a good case. So did you. And I'm sorry that you're here.
I don't know how they sleep, honestly, these defendants, as they wait. And sometimes it's days upon days. Mark, you're just the best. You've had these great experiences. You're sober. You think things through. And that's why I adore you. Thank you so much.
Sure thing. Good seeing you again. Talk soon.
Mark O'Mara, just one of the best in the business without question. I'm going to turn now to a tragic death in Seattle that may have been preventable. A 13-year-old boy reportedly watched his own dad die from a heart attack while the fire department was sitting outside waiting for permission to enter his home. According to the police sources, an unidentified teenager called 911 last week to report that his dad needed help. But when the firefighters arrived, they were told they had to wait for the police before they could enter his home. And the reason for that actually makes sense. An outdated city hazard note connected to that address. Note saying that the resident had a history of aggression towards first responders. So that was problem number one. Problem number two was that the police precinct was reportedly down to just two officers. And it took more than 20 minutes for the police to get there. The firefighters actually took it upon themselves to enter the home and just go for it, just begin first aid. And that was about 5 minutes before the cops got there. But unfortunately, it wasn't soon enough, and the man died. This raises some pretty important questions. What are these notes? What? Linked to certain addresses? Saying that some people are dangerous inside? And could a note on your home affect how quickly first responders might get to your family? And by the way, there is a huge twist in this case. I say this a lot, I'm going to say it again. Get a bourbon for this one and buckle up. Experts are going to weigh in with some critical information next. Welcome back to Banfield. A 13-year-old boy reportedly watched his own father die from a heart attack because the fire department wasn't allowed to enter the home. An outdated note on the address said that the resident that lived there was aggressive and that they should wait for the police to arrive before they enter. The biggest problem here, that aggressive resident, he didn't live there anymore. He'd moved out. But the police also didn't show up for more than 20 minutes. And 20 minutes was just too long. The man died. I'm joined by two people who know more about emergency services and first responders than anyone. Carmen Best is the former chief of Seattle Police Department. Her book is called Black in Blue, Lessons on Leadership, Breaking Barriers, and Racial Reconciliation. And Chief Mike McCabe is the chief of EMS for the city of Bayonne, New Jersey. He also is the host of EMS World Podcasts. Welcome to both of you. It's great to have you. So, Mike, I'm going to start with you. I kind of just could see your blood boiling on this one, right? The EMS, they're there. They know what's going on, but they have been told someone's dangerous in there. And that's no joke either. And they have to wait for police. And they know that there's a little boy in there who's possibly watching his dad die. What would you do?
Yeah, it's very difficult, Ashley. You know, first and foremost, we're always taught scene safety for the providers. And these CAD notes, as they're called, are computer-aided dispatch, which are the systems that we utilize in our communication centers. It's not uncommon for them to have notes inside of them, which are there really to protect the provider. And in this case, it was done for that very reason. But unfortunately, with these computer-aided dispatch notes, if they're not updated regularly, you run the potential of having old information, which was obviously the case here, which resulted in a tragic outcome. And it certainly is difficult to, you know, sit there and wait for the okay to go in, especially when units aren't arriving, knowing that inside that residence, somebody is dying. It's very difficult.
You mentioned, Mike, the updates. So I have been hearing that sometimes these don't get updated for 2 years, which means every 2 years there's a chance of this happening.
There's certainly the possibility. Again, it really depends upon agency. It really depends upon where you are. But regardless, this is certainly a possibility to happen at any given time. And it's a scary proposition. It really is a cautionary tale.
Okay, Chief Carmen Best, I think that you also would be seething to hear this because, you know, this is your life. This is your life's work. You don't want to hear that there's a precinct that has two officers that just doesn't have the manpower to help someone when they're dying.
Yeah, Ashley, thank you for having me. I do want to sort of recap the scenario as I understand it from reports that I've read that initially the firefighters responded and there was a hazard, what we call a hazard tag on the residence, on the address that had been put there by previous firefighter response on a medical situation where the previous person was combative. And so these are, safety notes that are often put on residences as officer safety issue and also a way to protect the resident inside so you can be better prepared to deal with whatever you confront when you enter the residence. In this particular case, as you've noted, the resident had moved and someone else was living in the home at that time. That does happen. We have hundreds of these types of flags on residences. As you said, you know, at least in the Seattle area, they're checked every couple of years or so. Just as a matter of practicality, you know, to check every residence every day would be very difficult. I, too, have responded myself to these types of calls as an officer, having to clear for firefighters to go in. Typically, if we go in and we find that the resident is not the resident that we thought it was, we'll make sure that the flag is cleared at that time. But as was stated, you know, there's a potential there for it to be a different resident inside. My understanding of the facts is that the officers were there in shortly under 15 minutes. And at that time when they got there, the firefighters, rightfully so, had decided to go ahead and make entry on their own and perform life-saving measures. As we all know, tragically, those measures did not save this victim in this particular case.
So tragically. Mike, I don't know if you know the answer to this, but, can I call somewhere and, like, make sure that the file doesn't have a guy who moved out the year before and make sure that I, if I have a problem, everyone will know it's okay to come in? Can I proactively protect myself?
I would say typically not, Ashley. That's something that's going to come through your 911 system. So in order to do that, you would actually have to call 911 so that it would go through the system. Otherwise, the local law enforcement or the local police department would have to have a number that you would call for them to check their records. And I really don't think that that's something that they want to get into. It really would come down to the case of this really isn't differently, thank goodness. But it is something that happens. And again, sometimes it's unavoidable in a sense like we cannot check every day to make sure that that person is still living in that home. But, you know, thank goodness, as I said, it's not something that happens often. And the fire department did have the right to go in there. Certainly they took a risk in doing so, but it's certainly a risk that most likely I would say 99% of responders would take.
Okay, last quick comment from you, Chief Best, and that is we've seen the crazy people in the skies just, you know, losing it, right? Thousands of these instances in the skies, and I can only equate it to being post-pandemic. The pandemic has turned us all into, like, complete idiots. And I wonder if you're also seeing a correlation between aggression, not just against police, but against EMS, just the fact that there may be more of these notices that are attached to residences now because, once again, we've lost the plot.
Yeah, well, it's always a concern about officer safety and first responder safety, to include the firefighters. And, you know, we're in a very stressful time, people out of work and other issues compounding the stress that people are experiencing inside their homes. As you know, when the pandemic first hit, there was a higher level of domestic violence and those types of issues. So there's always a risk involved. And certainly during the stressful times, we can expect that there might be more. One of the reasons, in fact, that they have the system in place so that they can make annotation on the call if, in fact, there's a potential for violence to occur. Again, this is really tragic that this man died. I know the firefighters did go in. They recognized that every minute counts, and they didn't wait for the officers. They went ahead and went in to perform life-saving measures.
Just so sad. Chief Carmen Best, thank you. Chief Mike McCabe, good to see you again, as always. Love you both. Thank you.
Great seeing you, Ashley. Thank you.
Thank you.
Still ahead, the trials of Ghislaine Maxwell, as in tribulations, as in nobody knows the trouble she's seen. But the real trial itself starts tomorrow, and the real troubles, 80 years worth, might not be far behind. Welcome back. 16 months after the FBI arrested Jeffrey Epstein's longtime confidant and alleged co-conspirator, Ghislaine Maxwell, she's going to go on trial tomorrow in Manhattan. Federal prosecutors and Maxwell's lawyers are going to start all that questioning tomorrow. More than 200 New Yorkers are going to be questioned, with the attempt to seat 12 of them and six alternates. And that could take several days, and it will not be fun for anybody concerned. But for Maxwell, who has now spent 16 months in the federal lockup in Brooklyn, it may at least be a welcome change. That is, if you have read the story in the Daily Mail, a story that she has done in an interview talking about being served maggot-infested apples and sharing a cell with a rat from an open sewer and swearing off showers because of, quote, creepy guards who stare at her naked. It's pretty much as far removed from Maxwell's former life of private jets and gated mansions as any person could possibly get. And Maxwell got here by allegedly procuring young underage girls for Epstein and his rich and powerful friends. And I did say allegedly. Maxwell faces numerous sex trafficking counts that could send her to prison for 80 years. But for now, she is convicted of nothing. And so now I turn to my experts about what she's saying about her lockup conditions. Stacey Honowitz is the longtime head of the Sex Crimes and Child Abuse Unit for the State Attorney's Office in Broward County, Florida. She's also written several children's books, including My Privates Are Private. Larry Levine is a consultant for people just like Maxwell, headed to jail and unsure of what comes next. Larry served 10 years himself in federal prison, so he knows what he's talking about. He now runs Wall Street Prison Consulting. Welcome to both of you. Okay, Larry, you heard what Ghislaine Maxwell is saying to the Daily Mail. It's horrible, and she's regularly threatened by the guards, and the lights are on 24/7, and she's got eye damage from these fluorescent lights, can't get sleep. The food is rotten. There's no protein. Is she off, or is that pretty much how you'd sum it up?
Well, okay, when I went into custody, I had 20/20 vision myself. I spent almost 2 years at MDC Los Angeles. They wouldn't let me go out and go in general population. They said I was a threat to the institution. Who knows? But the fact is, my eyes went when I was in custody. And when I ended up at a real prison and I was watching a movie, I thought, why is this blurry? It never dawned on me that my eyes had an issue. It was the fluorescent lighting. As far as the food, right now, the BOP, the Federal Bureau of Prisons, they are understaffed all across the country. Food supplies are not getting in. I've got clients at institutions all over the U.S. So what she is saying, it's true to a certain point. I mean, she's in the SHU. She's in the special housing unit. She's not in general population. They keep her lights on 24/7 because the cops, the COs, are going to come by with a flashlight and they're going to shine it in the little the rectangular window on her door. There's no bars or anything. You know, after what happened allegedly to Jeff Epstein, they don't want anything to happen to her. And as far as the showers, I mean, yeah, they will. I don't think they're standing there leering at her. I don't buy that. But I believe that if she's taking maybe a 5-10 minute shower, whatever amount of time they're going to give her, the correctional officers, they're making their rounds through the cell block. I've been in the SHU, and they're just looking in to make sure she's alive. I mean, rotten food, it's everywhere. I mean, she's not used to this. I think she's being a crybaby, to be honest with you. She's got to suck it up.
I can imagine the change in her life has been so palpable. Stacey, what might be even more concerning than the conditions that she's talking about is the treatment of her with respect to her ability to prepare for her own trial. She's a smart cookie. She could certainly aid in her own defense and has been working hard to do that. But here's what she says. She's having trouble speaking to her lawyers. She didn't have a proper desk to work on. They provided her with computers that do not work. And her mail, her lawyer's mail, which is supposed to be privileged, has come slit on the bottom with stamps that originally were on it that are no longer on it. So tampered with. That has to be troublesome just from, you know, a perspective of jurisprudence.
Well, Ashley, you know, this is not the first time that she's ever raised these concerns. This is the final article that we're seeing in print. But her lawyers have gone in a couple of times and have raised these issues with the court. They've told the court that they want the ability to have more contact with her. And so all the things that needed to be done had already been brought to the court's attention. Now, with regard to her mail, she has to know that when the mail comes in, it's looked at to make sure that there's nothing in there. That is just protocol. Anybody that will tell you that any contraband is looked for if it's, you know, comes through the mail or if anybody goes to visit, anything like that. So all of these things that she's talking about and that she's raised have come into the courtroom, have been before the court, and now she's finally telling her story so that everybody gets to see it in print. Now, it came out right before jury selection. Are they hoping that people see some of this and there's kind of a sympathy ploy to this? Of course. You can't be, you know, you have to be ridiculous not to think that she is trying to get that. On the other hand, is it fair that she's treated maybe differently? Well, of course not. Nobody wants to be treated or, you know, tortured while they're in prison. But like I said, the court was well aware. Her lawyer, she's got fine lawyers, and I know that they've gone before the court. They have put all of these things in motions. They filed it, and they've asked the court for relief. And thus far, there hasn't been. So the court has heard
there
something.
There hasn't been.
And we're not, there hasn't been. You know, she's, so the court heard something that we don't know about.
She's down 20 pounds, apparently. And for a girl, that's a lot. She's gone gray. I don't suppose that's unusual. You don't get, you know, hair stuff in jail. I want you to see her, though, because we talk about Ghislaine Maxwell. So she's like this sort of fantasy character because you just don't see her or hear her. And we found a moment where she was actually interviewed by the HuffPo, Huffington Post. I was shocked when we found this, but here she is talking about this charity that she started called Terramar, you know, helping the oceans to be clean. But take a look. This is Ghislaine Maxwell.
You can't just keep expecting everything to keep going, to the fish to keep breeding and the ocean to keep healthy, because it just doesn't work that way. And I think the ocean is just too big to fail.
just surprising to kind of see her come to life. But just quickly, I need a fast comment from both of you. Larry, pretrial detainees are innocent, right? They are innocent. They haven't been proven guilty
yet.
Innocent. Shouldn't their treatment be better?
Hold on. Well, let me jump back to the mail. The protocol is if it's legal mail, they have to open it in front of you. So it's not pre-opened. It's not pre-screened. And then they pull the postage stamps off because there's a concern whether or not drugs are going to get into the institution. And the reason why they have her in isolation, she's not like some regular inmate that could just blend into the prison population. Everybody knows who she is. Being a CHOMO, child molester, as they call it, that's like one of the worst crimes, like being an informant. And if they had her in, you know, general population, somebody would kill her. Guaranteed, it would happen.
So last comment, Stacey, and that's this. I think a lot of people who watch this process might understand this question. You can't try Jeffrey Epstein. He's gone. And the prevailing wisdom out there is that someone's got to pay. And I think her lawyers are saying that's what's happening with our client. They're going after her. They're treating her this way because they think someone's got to pay. And that's not fair, they say. What do you say?
Well, of course that's going to be their defense, that she's paying for everything that happened with him. But these victims are going to take the stand and tell you that she was an integral part of trafficking because she's the one that, for lack of a better term, seduce these girls to come into his life. Now she'll say, I didn't know what was going on. But one by one, they are going to take the stand, and they're waiting to see if one of the British victims can come in. And they are going to say that I came to Jeffrey Epstein through Maxwell. I would never have gone to him if it was not for her. So, of course, we are waiting to hear that defense, that the defense is she's taking the blame for him. The prosecution's going to say no. We finally got her, and she is just as responsible for what went on with the trafficking as Jeffrey Epstein was.
Stacey Honowitz and Larry Levine.
Though, all those other people, hold on, all those other people that were involved in this, it's a conspiracy. So they will draw other people in, and her lawyer is probably working on something called a 5K1, perhaps where she could give substantial assistance to get whatever sentence lowered. Just think of the secrets this woman is hiding.
Oh,
I mean, it's a little late in the game. She should already be cooperating.
No, she's not. She would have cooperated for the last 16 months. Are you kidding me? She's getting ready to go to trial tomorrow.
Yeah, I think she would have cooperated before now, because now it's going to be a hot mess if she's convicted.
You don't know that.
I got to cut
there, though. Your lawyer there in Florida, she doesn't know that either, what's going on behind the scenes, what she said,
the
interviews that she's given. A lot of this stuff nobody knows.
Yeah. I have to leave it there. But you know what? I'd love to have you both back, because I think that we're going to start hearing a lot of really interesting stuff, especially when it comes to jury selection. The first question is, have you heard of this case? And, you know, it's New York. Everyone's heard of this case. Stacey Honowitz and Larry Levine, thank you both. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Ash.
Sure.